Welcome back to another episode of Latin America Review. And today we're going to be talking about El Salvador, aren't we, Camila?
Yep, we've wanted to speak about El Salvador for a really long time. There's been a lot going on over the past 2 years, specifically under the government of President Nayib Bukele. For that, we brought on two Salvadoran friends, economists, and activists, who will explain a little bit about the current context. So we'll get back to Ollie in a bit.
And it's also your country, as well, Camila. Maybe some of the viewers or listeners won't know that.
Yeah, I think a lot of people think I'm from a number of countries, but actually my parents are from El Salvador, and I've had the opportunity to go and spend a lot of time in El Salvador, specifically in the last year. And it's, you know, a country that I've tried to cover off and on, but it's been very difficult. You know, the economic situation there is very difficult. There's lack of opportunity, and that's something that we're going to be speaking about with these two young people today. Well, guys, thank you so much for joining us. Like I said, we have two guests on with us today. We have my good friend Roberto Zapata, who is based in San Salvador, but is also joining us from San Miguel today. He is an activist with an organization called Amate El Salvador, and he's also an LGBTI activist and someone who appears quite frequently in the media. And also joining us today is Tatiana. She's a feminist economist based in and joining us from San Salvador. Thank you guys so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for inviting us, and hello to all the people who see us, and a pleasure to share with you and with Zapata, the person that I admire so much.
Tatiana, let's start with you. You know, there's so many things I would like to ask about, but I think one of the most important things that we need to talk about is kind of like the context of the economic situation in the country right now. I think, you know, what people have seen in the exterior and in the mainstream media, and oftentimes in the media throughout Latin America, is that there appears to be very strong support for the current president, Nayib Bukele, and a lot of support for his policies, generally speaking. I think the thing that strikes me is that if, you know, his policies are so strong and everything is going so well in the country, the question is, why do people, especially young people of our age category, continue to leave the country seeking opportunity on the exterior? So tell us a little bit about the situation in the country right now, economically, for average working class Salvadorans.
So El Salvador has a lot of structural problems. Like, we have a lot of dependency of international economy, and specifically United States economy. So with the remittance, and with the dollarization and the free commerce that we have with United States, we have a lot of vulnerability between what happened in United States, the world, and in El Salvador. And that structural things has been going on the last decades. And actually, there's nothing that this government, Nayib Bukele's government, has done to change the structural problems that we have economically. So yeah, he is a very popular president, because he and his government, it's so good at this narrative between, like, this polarization between good and bad, and he's good and everything, and the rest is bad. So right now, I think that most of his popularity is based on the hope that something will change. But right now, there's nothing on the economy that has really changed for the people. And like, the major policy that has been made at this point is just Bitcoin. And actually, like a year from the implementation, we have no like results, like good results for the people or for the Salvadorian families.
I guess if you would like to add on to that, Roberto, because like the two of you, Tatiana and Roberto, are people who speak English and have probably had, you know, opportunities and friends who live on the exterior, opportunities to go to school and do other things elsewhere. And people like us, you know, such as myself, you know, have literally traveled around all of Latin America seeking a better life, knowing that the country I want to live in most, El Salvador, is a country that is least available for me because of all the different problems. I guess, like, how have you seen things change? How would you grade things within El Salvador in that respect, in terms of have they improved at all? What do you see as happening in these last couple of years?
Well, like Tatiana was saying, I think has been some change, but in not good terms. First of all, we have seen a lot of changes in how the government is being directed. And I think probably a lot of people have seen, even in mainstream media, about the authoritarian measures that Nayib Bukele has taken in different dimensions of the social life here in El Salvador. And this has a direct impact in the communities that are more poor. And that's sometimes something that you don't see quite in social media, especially because the government has a really big and strong propaganda machine that's really that has been really able to control a lot of the narrative that the people has here in El Salvador within the country, but as well even outside. So that's something that Tatiana was already mentioning. And but the truth is that for a lot of the working class families here, the situation has not changed for good, like I said. Especially in this last year, we have seen prices gone up a lot, and not an increase of wages, not an increase of measures from government to tackle this issue that's really affecting the majorities. And the same applies for other aspects of life. For example, in this state of emergency that has over 5 months now, and it's again impacting more the poorest communities in El Salvador. And you see probably like two sides of the story, the one that's good, the one that's taking over that's controlled completely by the government and the people that is around it. And the other one is the one that's trying to reflect this other reality. That's really a big contradiction between the two. And but for some people, because probably like Tatiana was saying, they really want to believe in something that's going to change. If not now, probably it will in the near future. But so far, it's still not something concrete or have been materialized for the working class families.
And Tatiana, one of the things that, you know, Nayib Bukele became known for and is in the media for has been the Bitcoin law, and obviously the response to the Bitcoin law. Can you explain to us what that has been and what the implementation of Bitcoin has been, the Chivo wallet, and how, you know, how that's been experienced by regular Salvadoran people? And if in any way that has affected the economy from how it was before that.
Yes, but it's important to say that the legalization of Bitcoin as a national currency in El Salvador was something that we actually discovered from a Miami conference in Bitcoins. So we have no idea that this will happen. And this gives you an example of how they construct a public policy in El Salvador. So it was not a response to a specific economic problem for the people in El Salvador. It was something that has made for men specifically, but for people in Bitcoin, like businessmen in Bitcoin and the government. So it was something that we were not expecting. and actually something that we were not asking as Salvadorians. Like, that was not our problem. Like, the main economic problem in El Salvador was not that Bitcoin is not a legal currency in El Salvador. So, but well, it was implemented and it cost, like, just the implementation cost around $200 million for the ATM machines, the wallet, and the bonus on the wallet. And actually, we have no specification about the objectives of this measure, but what we know is that they were trying to make this wallet, this government wallet, as a tool for financial inclusion for El Salvador. And that includes financial inclusion about remesas, about remittance from United States to El Salvador. But at this point, what we know based on statistics from the government is that just the 1% of the remittance has been made through a wallet, virtual wallets. So it's not working because most of the people has no extra money to invest in something like Bitcoin, which is a very risky asset. So at this point, what Bitcoin has, what the implementation of Bitcoin has been made in El Salvador is just make more, a little more difficult to have a financial, like financially, like the government has a lot of difficulties to found a financial institution who can give us money to like pay our debts or work like for the budget, for the national budget. So at this point, it just has been a really expensive measure that has not been that has not become in a really good tool for most of the people in El Salvador. Like, no for financial inclusion, no for taking people out of poverty, no for jobs, no for most of the economical problems that we have.
When this was coming about, you know, there was discussion over what Tatiana just said, which is the possibility of a greater financial inclusion. We heard, you know, that so many Salvadorans don't even or didn't at the time have a bank account. Like Tatiana said, it seems like it's not really being utilized for sending remittances. So what good is the Bitcoin? What's your take on that, Roberto?
Like Tatiana was saying, people was not really asking for this, was not expecting it. And when the government pushed it to be one of the main economic policies, it was probably one of the first times when the majority of the people said, hey, this is probably not a good thing. And for a lot of families, there is still the memory of the dollarization and how it was implemented here in El Salvador, that it was a very unpopular move. So the same goes with this now Bitcoin law. So people started saying, even in service, that that was something that it was not going to improve their daily livelihoods. So I think that it was a big take on the government to do that, and it has not done very good with the families. But along with these economic policies, we have to say that there have been a lot of push in moving militarization. And that's very important because you have on one side, this policy that is very unpopular, and the government is using this other one, like to make people forget about the other one that really doesn't do any good for them. And this other one, the militarization, it's not good for a lot of people, but the government is using the propaganda machine to make people believe that things are changing thanks or as a result of this militarization. And it's not something that we have seen in just in this recent state of exception, but it has been probably something since the very beginning of this government. We have seen the budget of the defense going up almost a double, and as well, even Nayib Bukele is saying that he wants to double military people, and that means over 40,000 people, and it's not just anyone, it's mostly working class youth, because, you know, it's the people that really don't have many opportunities in El Salvador. So basically what the government is saying, if you're doing bad economically, if you feel that you don't have any opportunities, well, you can become part of the military forces and help us do repression policies and measures to supposedly tackle gangs. But we have seen that there have been a lot of people saying that and families, and even making march up and demonstrations to say that a lot of people that the government is detaining are innocent, and they have really not any link with the gangs. But the government is just making these big things to in order to detain people in areas where people know that there are gangs. But there's a lot of things that we can say about this, but I don't want us to forget that along with these economic policies, there have been other policies in order to make people forget about the things that are really impacting their lives.
Can you tell us a little bit about what the response has been to the violence, the crime, and the gangs, and, you know, what people are saying about that in the country right now?
Well, that subject is very difficult, because if you ask people in the areas where they struggle the most about poverty, unemployment, actually one of their main problems was the gangs. Like, the gangs really harass them every day. So I think that they see that has been an improvement in the fact that now is there's no that much control of the gangs in their territories as it has been the last decades. But it's really important to know and to analyze why that is happening and what are we doing as a society and what the government is doing to make sure they have control of these territories. So what they are doing is actually, yeah, militarizing all the territories and actually taking people, like a lot of people, into jail. And that's something that we need to analyze from the perspective that is this idea that jails and that putting people into jail, it's actually the social response or the adequate response to all the problems that we have in El Salvador, that we have in our societies, because we are not actually approaching the main problems of violence, which are like problems with poverty, migration, etc. So there's a lot of problems that we are not approaching. So we are like, the government is like, okay, so we have this huge problem on violence. Let's put a lot of people into jail so we forget about these people. Like, they are not human beings. Like, they are not part of the society. So we just take it into jail. And yeah, probably there will be a lot of people there that are not from gangs, but the president says, so yeah, there's a margin of error in all that you do. So probably there's people there that it's not from gangs, but that's what we have to do in order to have control of these territories. So actually, it's really what it's difficult. It's that the government it has been very effective in this black and white narrative. So if you like. These two things could be happening. Like it could happen that the territories are being controlled by the state, so the gangs are having less control than what they used to have, and that the measures that they are taking are very contrary to human rights or to a social perspective that what we have to do as a society. So if the two things could be happening at the same time, but in a narrative of black and white, you can only choose one side. So it's everything good or it's everything bad. And I think that the government is pushing all this communication machine to make sure that people seem like, okay, if you want to be safe, you need to... like support all the things that it's happening right now to make you feel safer right now. So at this point, I think that people in El Salvador, it's just in front of like, you have to choose between who's going to like suppress you, like the gangs or the state. And most people will choose the state right now. So they will feel safer right now with a lot of policies and militaries in their territories. But we know, like from the history, that that's not like the accurate response or like the integral response to these type of problems.
Roberto, I want to ask you about this week, a new either ambassador to El Salvador from the United States, or maybe it's the charge d'affaires, arrives there and met with the foreign minister, and they're smiling and shaking hands and everything. But, you know, just within the last year, we've seen a lot of these claims from, especially around the Latin American foreign media, you know, trying to position also Bukele's own supporters within the country, trying to position Nayib as some sort of anti-imperialist or some sort of revolutionary or whatever else. It's quite bizarre, but you know, even saying that, like, that President Nicolas Maduro of Venezuela is like in the pocket of the United States, whereas Nayib is actually the person contesting U.S. imperialism. Very bizarre takes and ways of painting him and framing him. How would you characterize the U.S. influence on El Salvador, sort of dissonance between the two, the Salvadoran government and the U.S. government? Would you say in any way that Nayib Bukele's administration is contesting U.S. imperialism, or you know, proposing something new or something that you know, something beyond the system of U.S. imperialism?
No, I don't think that Nayib Bukele's government is contesting U.S. imperialism at all. He's just a very opportunistic government. So we remember that whenever Donald Trump was in power, this government was a bit, or tried to be as close as it could be from that U.S. government. So now that the government changed and there has been some criticism to certain policies of El Salvador government, then now he is trying to use this narrative positioning himself and his government to be some sort of critic to the U.S. Policies or international policy. But really, what we have seen is that, like I said, it's something very opportunistic. I'm sure that if anything happens in the near future in the U.S. government, like, for example, Republicans taking over, the Nayib Bukele will come again to terms in his narratives. in order to say that the U.S. has been a long partner of El Salvador and that they have a common future, etc. So really, I believe that it's something just to play with the narrative and to make people, again, think about something else rather than hit their really problems of their daily lives. So this is probably something that really works for him in certain portions of the population here in El Salvador, and even in the U.S., where we know there is a part of the Salvadorian diaspora that is probably not really fond of the current government of the U.S. because it has been this criticism or to Nayib Bukele, where that, and they believe that Nayib Bukele is doing great. So I really believe that we should just probably take more about a more historic approach to this analysis over what position the Salvadorian government has in U.S. imperialism and its role in the international community.
I would like to ask you, Tatiana, given that you're a feminist activist there in El Salvador, one of the other, I guess, misconceptions or conceptions of Nayib has been that he gives off, you know, progressive vibes, I would say. I think there's a lot of people who believe that El Salvador previously had some very conservative policies and that under the former FMLN government, they were not able to legalize abortion. You know, how would you score Nayib Bukele's administration in these first years in terms of has he been able to implement change that has benefited women and other vulnerable groups?
Well, I think it's really important to understand that the responses that Nayib and his government will have about a subject will be based mainly on communication strategies and not on principles. So if the people that has the authority to respond to all these subjects will find out that feminism is it's a good approach to a response to something specifically right now, they will use feminism, but it's not coming from principles. It's the same that it's happening when he criticizes United States. It's not that he has this principle or these political principles about criticizing imperialism or the policies on United States. It's just that right now these ideas or these rhetoric ideas, it's something that will help him to approach this moment in particular. So he has, based on that, he will use a lot of our speeches in order to be popular in some specific time. Like at the beginning, he was telling feminism movements like, yes, I will support some ideas from like abortion or legalization of some progressive ideas like equality in marriage or a lot of things, because that was something that will help him to be popular in those groups. So as soon as he get what he wanted from those groups, that was like popularity or backup, political backup or something, he will just forget about what he has been told to them and what he has been told to the society. At this point, what we have and the facts that we have is that most of policies for women's equality has been like completely destroyed, or they have reduced the financial the finance to the money to finance these programs. That's what we have in facts. And in the last months, we have been struggling with a lot of ideas coming from the Congress, specifically from women's, a lot of Congresswomen's from Nayib's political party that are really pushing this idea that feminism or the politics that we have, the laws that we have, and that has been conquered for feminists are not working, and that like this idea that we need like a policy for men. If you have policies for women, you need policies for men. Like this horrible idea that they need to respond the same to the problems that we have as women and the problems that men have. So that we have at this point, yeah, there's a lot of information. There's a lot of things that he could have said before, but at this point, what we know is that there has been nothing done to push an equality, an agenda for gender equality or nonviolence against women.
I think one of the things that has really confused people on the exterior and people who are not Salvadoran is that on the one hand, like we just discussed, he seems to have repudiated and rejected some of this US interventionist actions or moves to try to make statements on the state of things in El Salvador. And at the same time, Nayib has kind of maintained an okay relationship with China. And so many anti-imperialists on the exterior, you know, are very much pro-China and very much in favor of developing together through cooperation projects, large infrastructure projects with China. How do you see things in terms of Nayib's ability to juggle things with the US and also with China? What is the relationship like with Russia? Do you see any improvement in terms of infrastructure? And I'm just throwing a lot of questions at you at the same time, just because I'm trying to get them all in. You know, are things improving on the ground in terms of infrastructure and people's quality of life and the things that are very necessary to bridge, you know, some of the economic needs of the rural area? And lastly, I also want to ask, you know, like, to what extent is El Salvador resilient amid the current economic, crisis in the world, and in terms of, you know, the need for fuel and maintaining stable prices, and of course with food security and producing its own food within, you know, the context of the conflict overseas, in which we're seeing huge inflation all around Latin America. How is the government handling of that? Give us one last score for all of these different issues for how things are in El Salvador.
Well, first of all, about this issue on China and the U.S., I agree with Tatiana that probably the main strategy for the government with that and with everything is their interest to be popular and not any type of principle. So if in any time this government feels that China might not be going along with what they want, they probably would start saying something bad about China. And the same goes for any other government, because that's what they really care, whatever the people is thinking about them, because that way they can maintain the control to do basically anything that they want to do. And about these other, let's say, policies that the government is implementing or is not implementing on several dimensions of life. So, for example, in food security or food sovereignty, I think that's probably something that we have not been able to really see the government taking on. It's sometimes he's doing just very basic or superficial policies in order to make people believe that they are doing something about that. But in practice, that really doesn't result in anything concrete for the people. And we have talked to many people in rural areas on the work that we do, that they say that they are not receiving the packages the way they did before on previous governments, for example, and that now with all the prices increased, they don't believe that is a really good choice for them to keep doing the agricultural work that they have done all their life. And they prefer to try other things. And the government response to that will be probably just import more food from other countries, and especially China, like we have, like we saw during the first month of the pandemic. And so I believe that all these things are just telling us that this government really doesn't have a plan, an economic plan, but he's just responding to whatever situation they see, and they try to make people believe that they thought about it before, but really they didn't, and they are just trying to respond to whatever situation. So, for example, we have a very big problem in the main cities in El Salvador. Whenever there is a big rain, for example, everyone is talking about that. Whenever there is a big rain, because the cities are flooded, and the government tries to say, no, we will do something about this, but then the rain stops, and like probably a lot of people forget about that, and the government as well, and then another rain happens. So, and it's something like that with everything the government is doing. Not something planned, and of course not consulted with social organizations. It's just something that they are trying to do in order to make people believe that they thought about it before.
And one last question for Tatiana. I'll have you end this section of the program with the question that everybody asks me all the time, which is what happened with the Frente Farabundo Martí, the FMLN, and what's going to happen in these next elections? Is Nayib Bukele going to be allowed by the people and the institutions to run once again, even though it's supposed to be against the Constitution? What do you believe will happen? And what has been kind of the resistance to that, or what are people doing about it to avoid another term?
Well, what has happened is that Nayib Bukele and his government and his political project was to destroy the party system in El Salvador. And there were a lot of people asking for that. Like, a lot of people wanted to destroy the party system because they believe that the party system is just ARENA and FMLN. But I think that was not, like, they didn't think that so well, that the party system is more than that. And that's the base of the democracy that we have in El Salvador. That it was not the best democracy or what we wanted, but it was at least a good step based on what we have in the 90s and the 80s. So right now that he has destroyed the party system, there's actually no political party or political institution that has the power to has a good battle for in front of him. Like, there's nothing. He has the power of the institution from elections, the Tribunal Supremo Electoral. He has the power of most of communications in El Salvador. He has the power of the Congress. There's actually not that much that we can do. And there's not, based on my experience and what I see, like, we have a lot of people fighting this, like Roberto and a lot of organizations, like, fighting this. But at this point, I don't see that in the next elections we will have, like, a political body that will have a good battle in front of Nayib Bukele. So I think that he has like destroyed all these institutions, and it's not all his fault, or his government fault. I think that there's a lot of that we need to criticize for these institutions, but actually don't see that the way to make these parties stronger, or like FMLN is stronger, or to make sure that they will understand better what is happening in El Salvador. I don't think that the correct response is to destroy all the party system. And that was what's happened. So at this point, I think we have like very much less that we can fight.
And Roberto, I just want to ask you the same question, because I know that, like Tatiana said, you are kind of with the organizations on the ground, on the social movements. So what do you think is going to happen in this current period? And maybe if you can comment also on how things are in terms of the media in El Salvador, because I know that's a really big problem as well.
So in terms of the next election, it's probably, there's a good chance that Nayib Bukele will run again. And so that's something that people is on the opposition is trying to figure out how to handle, because it's illegal, because it's not something that probably even some people in the opposition was not expecting that it was going to happen. A lot of people probably thought that he was going to use someone else in order to continue his political project. But not now. I believe that the majority agrees that he is going to run. And like Tatiana was saying, that means that we really don't know what rules the political parties are going to be playing with, because he basically controls all the institutions, and he can change whenever he wants these rules. And one of the things that the left have not been able to do in these past years is to reorganize in order to have a strong project that will contest Nayib Bukele's power. And even the same political parties of the traditional right are the same. They have not been able to reorganize in order to have a project that will be able to contest Nayib Bukele's power. So right now, I would say that we don't have any clarity onto what is going to happen in terms of what the opposition is going to propose for the next elections. I do have more hope that that social movements are trying to reorganize in order to keep, pushing forward a more critic analysis of the situation for the majority of the people. So in order to probably not just take on these on the next elections, but rather to make people believe, or to make people analyze their situation, and to contrast that with whatever the government is saying. So they see the contradiction and they have a more critic position onto whatever is happening. But that's probably something that we'll see results in the long term, and not for the next election that is just in over a year now. And that means that there's a lot of work that we have to do, social movements, activists, and even people in political parties, each one in their side.
Thank you so much, Tatiana and Roberto. I tried really hard to put like three shows into one here. There was a lot to cover, and I hope you'll join us again, each of you, to talk about this some more and in some other areas that we weren't able to hit on this time. And Casaju News really hopes to do more coverage of Central America, and specifically El Salvador, in the coming year, once we're over these massive Brazilian elections, and hope to be back on the ground in El Salvador sometime next year and see you guys there. Thank you so much.
Hi, guys. So for the second part of the show, which we'll do briefly, not won't be as long as the first part, we'd like to do a cultural section. And in this, what we do with each guest from each different countries is I propose an imaginary dinner party of the cuisine of your country, and then you evaluate it at the end. You give me a score out of 10, right? So for starters, obviously, we've got to go with El Salvador's most famous number one food known internationally, which is the mighty pupusas. And of course, for South Americans, I guess you could say similar to an arepa, corn flour, but the difference is that you got the ingredients like cooked inside the dough rather than sort of inserted afterwards. However, I was doing a little bit of, you know, research for this, trying to look up, you know, a bit of background history. And one of the first things I find was a YouTube video, viral, hundreds of thousands of views, saying, thanks to Nayib Bukele, the world now knows about pupusas. And I watched the video and it's saying essentially that basically no one knew about pupusas. It wasn't really a thing until an interview that Bukele did with Luisito Comunica, who's a Mexican like travel blogger. And since then, pupusas are like the number one Latin American food around, like internationally. And El Salvador is going to get loads of tourism now because of it. And it's all thanks to the mighty Bukele. So what do you reckon, Roberta, about that? Is the success of pupusas down to the great leader?
Well, no. I believe that if we have to thank anyone or anybody to the, let's say, the popular of the pupusas is the Salvadorian diaspora over different countries in the world, because they have taken our food with them and they have popularized it in wherever they go. So I believe that that's probably the main people that we should be thanking for the pupusa to be that popular in other countries.
And Tatiana, for the main dish, I was surprised to learn that El Salvador has its own enchiladas. Is this the same as Mexican enchiladas? If not, what are the main points of difference and which is better?
I think Salvadorian enchiladas are better because they are the one that I have closer. But it's fine. I like both, but I really love Salvadorian cuisine. And basically, enchiladas in El Salvador are like this tortilla and has meat in the top of the tortilla. So that's completely not the same enchilada that they had in Mexico, which are great. But I think it's actually faster to do a Salvadorian enchilada, which I think that's an advantage. For me, it's an advantage. I can do enchiladas really quick in El Salvador, like tortilla and meat and some vegetables in the top, and that's it.
Nice. And so obviously we've got to have a drink on the table. And I was interested to learn that El Salvador has a drink called chicha, also licor de chaparro. And I was interested because in Bolivia, obviously in the Andes, we drink a lot of chicha made in a number of different ways. One of the types of chicha, chichacuy, is made through chewing corn and spitting out. And then that's throughout process, it ferments and becomes alcoholic. Camila is not a fan of chicha, unfortunately. She can't share in the joys of it here in Bolivia. But what is Salvadorian chicha like? Is this the same sort of thing, same sort of drink? How's it made, and what sort of occasions would you have it in, Roberta?
Well, first of all, I say that even though we are a very small country, some of these foods that we're talking about are not made the same in different areas. So, for example, in the eastern side of the country where I'm from, there are certain differences even in pupusas. And we make a lot of jokes with this because the people from the San Salvador says jokes about eastern side, and the eastern side of the country say jokes about how the people in the capital eats the pupusa. And the same goes with chicha. So we have different ways or different traditions on how the chicha, what ingredients are used in order to make chicha. So usually it's corn, but there are some others that put other fruits in order to make this drink. The same as Camila, I'm not really a fan, but I have tried it, and I guess that once in a year, it's not that bad.
Sad. But, anyway, so we've also got music playing, you know, at dinner party, and El Salvador, a lot like Nicaragua and a lot of different countries, there's a whole genre of music of, you know, revolutionary music of the period of armed struggle, which in El Salvador was broadcasted through, you know, for example, Radio Venceremos, and created a whole crop of musicians that sang about the struggle. So, and the number one, as far as I'm aware, if you, you know, if there's one that you'd place above that, you can jump in, Tatiana. But number one is the number one revolutionary singer in El Salvador, Yolocamba Ita.
En toditos los rincones del campo y la ciudad, ya se siente el paso firme del miliciano que va a luchar.
Well, yeah, that's one of the main, like, popular bands and songs. But I think that I'm not like I'm a leftist, but I'm not very fan of the leftist, the common leftist songs. So I found cumbia very revolutionary. And Salvadorian cumbia also very revolutionary because it's an approach based on what the people or the ideas of the people and the culture of the people. So I think in my case, I'm not very fan of that type of music. I prefer cumbia. I'm sorry.
Okay. So to sum up, we've got, for starters, a plate of pupusas popularized by Nayib Bukele. We got a main course, El Salvadorian enchiladas. We got a jug of chicha on the table, and Yolocamba Ita playing in the background. So what would you give me as a score out of 10, Roberto? What areas of improvement, perhaps?
Because of the Nayib Bukele thing, I would say 6. if we remove that, I would put it 8.
Okay. What about you, Tatiana?
And I will give you, like, I will give you a 6 also. Yes. yes. There's no beer in the table, so
there's chicha.
Yeah, but it's not that it's not that easy to drink.
Okay, so this is actually the lowest score I've ever received on the reception of the show.
I wanted to give a score as well. I don't know why you didn't come to me. Well, the one thing you have to know is that me and Roberto have the same opinions and views on everything. So, like, the chicha is a no, but and the pupusa, like, for me, would be like the starter and the main and the dessert, because you just have like 12 of them. Like, you go in saying that you're gonna have like 2 or 3 maximum, and then you just have 12. And that's just like always going to be the case. They just keep coming around and you're just like eating them all day. It's literally horrible. But I mean, for those of us who don't have metabolisms. So I don't know. I think I have to agree with the 6, unfortunately. And that's generous. Right.
Okay, a generous 6. Fantastic. Okay. Well, thank you both of you for coming on.
Well, thank you guys so much for joining us. And we have so much more, like I said, to talk about with El Salvador. So we hope to have you on again sometime soon.